Hello and welcome to Season 2 of ICMA's Local Gov Life. I'm your host, Erica White. This season, we're sharing stories of crisis and resilience. From natural disasters to acts of violence, local government leaders are on the front line, responsible for guiding the staff and community through the crisis and its aftermath. These powerful stories are told by the people who lived and led through them. In today's episode, we'll hear a story about Hurricane Sandy, a massive superstorm that unleashed high winds and large-scale flooding in New York and New Jersey in 2012. Toms River, New Jersey, a township of 92,000 people, was at the center of the storm's destruction, suffering 9,200 damaged structures, 750,000 cubic yards of storm debris, and $38 million worth of damage to township property and infrastructure. ICMA member Paul Shivas, business administrator of Toms River, looks back at preparedness and response efforts, shares community challenges, and reveals lessons learned from the worst natural disaster in the state's history.
There are a couple of phrases as a municipal manager that I have come to adopt as my own, and one of them is adversity doesn't build character, it reveals it. And the other is that it's not what you're capable of doing, it's what you're willing to do. And in going through the episode with Hurricane Sandy and the recovery, I can promise you that both of those are absolutely true. Toms River Township is located in central New Jersey. It's a 42-square-mile municipality. It is the seventh largest in terms of population. But it's really a community of two different areas. We have a mainland area that encompasses about 35,000 structures, and a barrier island, which is another 6,500 structures. Toms River has the largest amount of linear footage of waterfront property in the state of New Jersey. And all of that would come into play as Sandy came and hit Toms River. Our preparation for Sandy started 2 weeks prior. You know, we are a barrier island community. We are aware of hurricanes, and every hurricane season, it is guaranteed that we will get at least one, if not multiple, notices of hurricanes that are coming up the coast. And so we were used to that. In October of 2012 was no different. We began to have daily meetings in the Office of Emergency Management every morning at 7:30, 7 days prior to Sandy. And everyone that could possibly be there was there. But here again, we had been through this before. But I will always remember the Friday and Saturday of that week when the director of emergency management, as he did with every meeting, started the meeting with a screenshot from the Hurricane Center of the projected path of Sandy. And at that point, it was pretty clear that it was going to make what we call the ominous left turn. Normally, the storms would come up the coast and at some point make a right turn out to sea. And that's what we were used to. Or they would make a left turn, but would not impact New Jersey significantly at all. Well, this looked like it was going to be different. And it certainly gave us every indication that this was going to be a serious problem, a serious event. So we made the decision that day, actually Sunday morning, to initiate a mandatory evacuation of the barrier island. The good news was this was October, so we didn't have the numbers of people that we would have had there on the barrier island had it been even September, a month earlier, or 3 weeks earlier. We had very good cooperation on the barrier island. We also issued what we called an advisory evacuation for the mainland waterfront properties as well. But we experienced something that I called the boy who cried wolf syndrome. We've been through this many, many times, as I said, at least once, twice, three times a hurricane season. And we'd heard all the dire warnings before, but up until this point in time in the history of the township, we never experienced the storm of this magnitude. Always that turn would go right. The storm would make that right turn, not a left turn. So the residents that lived on the mainland on waterfront properties, for the largest percentage, didn't go anywhere. They stayed where they were, and that would frankly create a bit of a problem as this evolved. But we began to do the things that we needed to do. We pre-staged all our assets. We put vehicles where they needed to be. We converted our police from regular vehicles up to four-wheel drives. We sent messages out via reverse 911, social media, TV, radio. Again, acknowledging that, look, it looks as if this storm is going to be real. If you live on the barrier island, you need to go somewhere quickly. We sent police door to door on the barrier island. And we also sent police door to door on the mainland. But again, people were very reluctant to go, and they didn't leave for the most part. We pre-staged public works equipment, which would become critically important. You wouldn't think it would be, but public works equipment ended up being a vital part of the rescue effort as the storm evolved. We worked with the school district. We had buses lined up to transport people to two shelters that we were able to open, to emergency shelters to get ready. We staffed those shelters. We worked with the Red Cross, and we made sure that there was food there, places for them to sleep, and all the things that needed to happen in advance. And we waited. But like I said, no one had ever seen anything like this before. So the anticipation was it'll be another time when we say, oh, thank God it spared us. Well, this one didn't. And what happened in this storm that had never happened in the history of Toms River was that not only did we get the rains and the wind, but we had something that never occurred before. And that was a breach where the ocean actually breached the island and went into the bay and filled up the bay. During the high tide situation, when that happened, the water levels began to rise very, very quickly. We're talking about feet in the matter of minutes when that happened, especially during high tide. And that affected all of the waterfront properties on the mainland. And that created the problem for us in terms of rescue. When it became too difficult, and it did very quickly, for emergency vehicles to get through, we had to tell our emergency rescue personnel to stand down. Their safety was at risk. So the only people that we could use were the public works employees in vehicles, and they made over 275 rescues that night. It was amazing. There were no fatalities in Sandy. There actually were no fatalities statewide, but there weren't any in Toms River. And that was largely because we had public works employees in high lifts, in Humvees, in anything we had to get people out. And they did a tremendous job. Those guys have been recognized by the township for their service. They sure as heck didn't sign on for that. I can tell you that. But they did the yeoman's work that night because there was nothing else they could get through those streets. When the dust settled, there were numerous gas leaks all over the place, which made rescues and daily life extremely difficult. As the waters started to recede, we started to see what the damage was, and it became evident right off the bat that the barrier island was a danger zone, and we could not allow people back there. So the first thing we had to do very quickly was we had to design a permit system and use school buses to have individuals come and get permits and be escorted by police in school buses back over to the barrier island so they could see the damage. But that didn't occur for almost a week later. We had to make sure that it was safe to go there. We used 120 school buses in the first week after Sandy. We had a problem because the electricity was out all over the municipality, including town hall. And that was October, the end of October. It was cold. We had no heat. And the electricity would not come back on for at least a week. But we had to function. We called a staff meeting of all the department heads 2 days after Sandy in the morning, and they all showed up. And you might say, well, what's remarkable about that? Well, three of them had homes that were destroyed, and they were here to do their job. We mapped out a plan. We got boots on the ground to assess damage. We wanted to do that before FEMA got here so that we could have some idea. And we were able to figure out that there were over 9,000 homes that had suffered some type of damage. Everything from minimal water damage all the way up to the homes gone, completely destroyed. We were able to figure out that of over the 9,000, of that, 4,000 homes were substantially damaged with with damage in excess of 50% of the value. We were able to determine that within 6 days after Sandy, which was critical. We then had some other short-term challenges. Like I said, no power, which meant no communication. The one effective way of communication, believe it or not, was AM radio. Our mayor and public information officer would go on the AM radio every day, twice a day, to give updates on what people should be doing and where, if they needed help, here's where they needed to go. When we finally got our website back up and going, like I said, that was about 7 days later when the electricity came back on. Oh, by the way, our emergency generator at Town Hall did not work. It failed. So we got an emergency backup emergency generator installed. But I said, by the time that happened, it was almost a week later. We had three fire trucks destroyed in Sandy, and we had over $38 million of damage just to our facilities on the barrier island. And that included the boardwalk, roads, any roads that were within close proximity to the ocean were destroyed completely. Our storm sewer systems, water systems, sewer systems, all the electric poles were down and gone. It was a sight to behold, one I would never like to see again. We had homes off their foundations completely that were in the middle of where roads used to be. We had homes that had gone off their foundations and ended up on somebody else's adjacent property. As I said, it's something that unless you see it, you almost can't believe it. It looked like a movie set. And the smell of natural gas permeated the air. It was really, as I said, kind of a very surreal situation. We now know that the Division of Taxation in New Jersey estimated the damage from Sandy statewide at a little over $4 billion. Of that amount, $2.25 billion was in Toms River. So no question that Toms River and Ortley Beach, which is part of Toms River, was ground zero of the storm. We had to also implement very quickly debris removal because individuals who had damage to their homes wanted to clean up. So we used contractors that we typically use for our snow removal program and put them on the street and began that process. We eventually would become part of a program the county implemented about 3 weeks later for debris removal under a shared services contract. But we wanted to make sure that we had, again, boots on the ground as quickly as we could, and we were doing debris removal by 6 days after Sandy. We ended up removing over 750,000 cubic yards of storm debris, or the other equivalent way to see that is 35,750 20-yard dumpsters. So it was a yeoman's job. It was a tremendous amount of work. Our department heads all did a tremendous job in not only being here, but also shepherding their staffs to do what needed to get done. We had to also, on the short-term basis, find office space for FEMA, which we were able to do. And the interesting part of this is that for 80% of our population, Sandy ended the day their power came back on. And those people rightly expected the services that we provide to continue. So we basically had what amounted to two different tracks of service delivery. For individuals whose power came back on and were not adversely impacted, we had to continue to pick up garbage and trash and police protection and all of those things. And yet for the barrier island and homes on the waterfront mainland that were damaged, we had to have additional police protection. We had to have debris removal service. So we definitely had to run two different types of governmental service delivery for a while, actually for a couple of years is how it ended up being. We also had the challenge of our tax base. We lost a significant percentage of our tax base. So we immediately initiated action by the governing body to adopt a resolution and ordinance to pass emergency notes in the amount of about $40 million that would allow us to continue to operate. In the meantime, we worked with the state of New Jersey. They requested federal funding to help offset some of the tax loss, and we're very successful in doing that. We were able to get funding. It was delayed about a year, but it certainly helped us a great deal, and they did a good job with that. As I said, the major challenge was to continue to operate for the 80% of the population that was not adversely impacted by Sandy. That was the biggest challenge, I think. And we were able to meet that challenge. Today, if you look, we're 5 years, just about 5 years post-Sandy. We will be in about a month or so, 2 months. And you can see the difference. We have about a 75% rebuilding rate. The properties that were damaged, we have about 75% of those reconstructed or elevated where they needed to be. We still have a way to go here. And all of the public improvements that needed to be reconstructed have been completed. And that includes the boardwalk at a higher elevation, new roads, new storm sewers, new water. All the utility companies have replaced their lines that needed to be replaced. It didn't go as quickly as we wanted it to go or as the residents wanted it to go, but it is now, those things have been completed. We are now about ready to put the final paving course on the roads over on the barrier island. We waited until all the utility companies replaced all their lines, and that's really the last big project we need to undertake, and that's going to get done this fall. For me, the lessons learned, I can't emphasize this enough. You have to have three qualities: broad shoulders, a thick skin, and a short memory. Because if you don't, it will completely overtake you, an event of this type. You have to be patient because your mettle is going to be tested. But as a municipal manager, yes, the mayor is going to be the face of this disaster, and rightly so. He's the individual that the residents are looking to for his leadership. But you in the background, you're the person that your staff is looking to. And although you will feel overwhelmed, and I can't imagine what the people of Texas are feeling today, but I can tell you that the managers in Texas are all feeling overwhelmed. That is the first feeling that you get. But you cannot reflect that to your staff. You have to be the person who is in control. You have to be ready to delegate, and you have to be thinking all the time on your feet. This is how we're going to do this. You're going to go through basically the five phases of grief. That's what it amounts to. And you have to be willing to accept that. Beware of media darlings on your staff. That's another piece of advice I will give you. Because in a disaster, the media is here 24/7, and they need someone to talk to. And it is very attractive to individuals sometimes on your staff who have not normally been contacted by the media to want to speak. But you have to be clear that we speak with one voice. That voice is through the public information officer who will set up the mayor for interviews. And it is critically important that once the disaster hits, that you transition any press from the emergency management side to the public information side. Because at that point, the Office of Emergency Management is overwhelmed with what they need to do. And it becomes a function of the public information officer to get the word out to the public. That's critically important. That's one of the things that I would highly recommend. Most importantly, FEMA. Hold FEMA accountable. We found it very challenging to deal with FEMA at times. They are very well-meaning. They have regulations they have to comply with. But one of the things you will find, FEMA has a policy that they rotate staff people out of an area after so many days. And they do that for the job satisfaction level of the employee, and we understand that. But when you are trying to rebuild a community as we were. We literally dealt with four different people over the time we needed them for our public works, the projects we needed to get done. Four different people. So we had to retell our story four different times. But they're not going to change that policy. So every 90 days or so, you'll notice that the person you've been dealing with is gone and somebody else is there. And although there are files there, they're not familiar with them. So patience, but be ready. You got to hold FEMA accountable. We had a wonderful consulting firm work with us. They are still in our building today. I'm going to be here a while because they are responsible for making sure we get every dime back of the money we spent. We get reimbursed by FEMA. We've already settled all our insurance claims, and that was a big mountain, but we were able to do that. And I think, lastly, for managers, very, very important for you to stay grounded. Don't let the situation overwhelm you, and you're going to find the need to take some time for personal time and space for you. Because if you don't, you're going to find that your patience level, your temperament is going to change. I think for me, it hit me the first time I was not here at work for a 12-hour day was Thanksgiving. And when I was home that day, it was surreal. Instead of it being the other way around, it felt unusual for me to be home. And then the next day I was home was Christmas. So I found it vitally important during that period of time to find something to reduce your stress level. I don't care if it's taking a walk around the block at work, whatever it is, you need to find something for yourself. Because again, you're going to be the person in the background that's going to be driving the ship.
That's our show for today. Let us know what you think of the episode by leaving us a comment at icma.org/podcasts. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating. Also, please share on social media and tell a friend about us. Thanks for listening to this episode of ICMA's Local Gov Life.